This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is The Informer, Australia's only LGBTIQ+ national news and current affairs show. Proudly sponsored by KHQ Lawyers. Passionate about being the best.
Our feature story tonight is about the rise of tech abuse and the ways that the legal system, police, family violence services, and the government are struggling to deal with this technological change.
Full disclosure, KHQ Lawyers is a sponsor of The Informer.
To begin with, we spoke to Monica about the prevalence of family violence.
So because most of the studies that we do see in this area and the area of family violence focus on heterosexual relationships, there are so many statistics on these. So we know that one woman a week in a heterosexual relationship largely is dying, though that's certainly been a constant over the past few years. But what we know about heterosexual relationships is that one in five Australian women have experienced sexual violence. One in six Australian women have experienced physical or sexual violence from a current or former partner. One in four Australian women have experienced emotional abuse by a current or former partner. And one in three Australian women have experienced physical violence.
Monica also unpacked the levels of family violence within the LGBTIQ community in particular.
So from our perspective, I mean, we have quite a big LGBTIQ practice, so we do a lot of work in this area. So from my perspective as a family lawyer working in this area, the prevalence is across all relationships. I don't see a difference because remembering that family violence at its essence and core is control. It's controlling behaviour, and it has it can accelerate over time depending on the circumstances and doesn't always need to include physical abuse. What I've found in sort of researching family violence, I do present a lot of papers in this area, is that there's actually not a lot of studies on these same-sex relationships and the prevalence of family violence. What I've been able to find from a 2018 study is that 92% of women who identify in a same-sex relationship or LGBTIQ have experienced sexual harassment in their lifetime.
Jesus.
In terms of males experiencing family violence, there was the Private Lives study, and that was one of the largest surveys of the LGBTI people that's ever been conducted. And that found that 33% of participants who had experienced intimate partner abuse, of those, 28% were men. So about a third were men.
That was Monica Blizzard from KHQ Lawyers, and she spelled out some pretty serious facts about domestic violence in the LGBTQI+ community. So we did a little bit of a research on our own, and we found some pretty serious facts. So as of 2015, almost one in three LGBTI Australians reported having been in a relationship where their partner was abusive.
62% of transgender males and 43% of intersex females have experienced abuse in their relationships.
And a 2010 survey in the US found that 44% of lesbian women and 26% of gay men have experienced physical forms of domestic violence.
According to research from the University of New South Wales, 75% of transgender, gender diverse and intersex respondents to their survey have experienced emotional abuse and 53% have experienced physical and or sexual abuse.
We are aware here at The Informer that some of our listeners may be experiencing family violence or grappling with what they can potentially do to escape violent situations.
We asked Monica to unpack some of the things that surprise her about family violence and advice she would have for people in violent relationships.
I think the thing that surprises me over and over again is how many people are, from my perspective, in a violent or abusive relationship, but they don't realise it. So understanding what violence or abuse is, I mean, I can talk about the legal definition, and that is violent, threatening, or any other type of behaviour that coerces or controls a family member or which controls the family member to be fearful. So its base is in control and in fear. But that can sort of flow through in many aspects in a relationship. So it could be financial control. It could be social control, not allowed to have close friends or family or socialise, all of those things sort of intermingled. So the first step is to recognise that it's happening. The second step is to, I guess, acknowledge that the relationship needs to end, because sometimes that's also a struggle for someone in this situation. Do they, often the people who are victims of family violence, love their partner? They want to be in that relationship. So there is a cycle of control and a cycle of violence, and recognising where you're at in that cycle is really important. But if the decision is you want to leave, you know this is an abusive relationship, getting legal advice, getting psychological advice. So when you leave your partner, when a relationship ends, it's no different to losing someone through death. You go through the same stages of grief. Often the person who is leaving has already done the grieving to an extent, so they're often in a better state of mind than the person who is being left. And that's where that power dynamic can sort of interplay. But from my perspective, I've got to identify the risk for the client. Mm-hmm. Are they at risk? Is this a case where we have a Rosie Batty scenario falling out? Is this a case where this person's at risk of being either physically hurt or killed? Mm-hmm. So I've got to try and look for the red signs, the red flags, and they can be asking questions around, has there been physical violence? Has it ever been threatened? It's interesting to know that family violence can often accelerate during pregnancy.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. Threats towards animals is another sign. If you've ever been... if there's ever been attempted strangulation, that's a huge red flag for me, because it's the statistics are something like you're 8 times more likely to be murdered by your partner if they've attempted to strangle you in any way, shape or form during the period of your relationship. So trying to identify the level of risk and then working out a safety plan. How do we get the person out? And often that might be connecting them with services. There are so many family violence services out there. In the community, there's lots of government assistance. You can get domestic violence support from the government. Mm. There's a government grant. Mm-hmm. We've done some work with the Salvation Army to actually assist clients trying to leave a violent relationship, and using that grant to get them legal outcomes. So getting them intervention orders, getting them parenting orders, or getting them safely out of there. So we've been trying to be a bit creative about how we can help people in real need in that way. But Our best way of saving or assisting clients in this scenario is early intervention, that is, before the separation occurs. So we plan the separation, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Where we add real benefit, I think, is if we can get the person an intervention order immediately, then communicate the intervention order to the perpetrator of violence, get them out of the house, allow the client to remain in the house if there are children, allowing the children to remain in the home can be such an important outcome, so that they've still got their ongoing support. And then if we need to, my job, and I do see my job as correcting the power imbalance that exists, can go in there and negotiate for financial support, to go in there and make sure the children are safe. If the children need to have supervised time with the other party, I can either go to the court and get orders to that effect, or I can try and negotiate that. So early intervention is the key. And there are specialist people like the Protective Group who we engage to go in and then make the home secure. So they do safety assessments of the home. So they'll change the locks, they'll put in security systems. There are security watches now that you can get through a government grant that actually have a GPS tracker. So for victims that are high risk, there are so many things out there that they may not be aware of. So just making sure that they are aware of what's available and the support they have.
If you're in a violent situation, you can call 1-800-RESPECT or find their services online at 1800respect.org.au.
You can also call Lifeline on 13 11 14, or for an LGBT-specific service, you can call QLife on 1800 184 527 or chat with them online at switchboard.org.au.
We spoke to Annabel Daniel, the CEO of Women's Community Shelters. Her organisation runs 4 community shelters in New South Wales. We asked her how technological abuse was changing their work.
The increasing use of what we call technological abuse is something that we deal with as part of our core business when we're responding to domestic and family violence. And these kinds of things can include phones that have been tampered with without a woman knowing, and with spyware inserted on there to record or track text messages, location settings, you know, on other forms of communication, so that the abusive partner would always know where she is and who she's talking to. There's also a rise in the use of things like tiles or tracking devices, you know, small things that can be attached to a key ring or placed in an invisible part of a car, and then their location will transmit back to, you know, to somebody who can be watching that. And obviously, too, what we also see is, as we have greater use of internet-enabled technology at home, is devices such as TVs, Google Alexa, those kinds of things that are increasingly used to potentially record and surveil the actions of women and children who are living in abusive relationships.
Mm. What proportion of the women who use your shelters are dealing with technological abuse?
It's hard to get an exact figure, but it's a significant enough proportion that we need to do a risk assessment with everybody that we admit. So it's actually part of our entry and intake procedures will include questions around that kind of thing and talking to people about what devices they have and whether they've ever had a sense that they are being tracked or what have you. And, you know, in these days that can include that whole gamut of things, not just the phone, but things like smartwatches as well. So it's a significant enough issue that we have to talk to every client about it.
Rosalie O'Neill is a senior advisor from the Office of the Federal Children's E-Safety Commissioner, and she explained that virtually all cases of family violence involve a component of technological abuse.
It is something that we see as part of the work we're doing with domestic and family violence frontline workers. We play an important role in training DV frontline workers to recognise what we call technology-facilitated abuse, and so that they can build that into their safety planning with their clients, and to make sure that their clients are aware that technology can, and in fact in most cases is, being used to perpetuate their whole cycle of domestic violence and domestic abuse. We know that from research that was done a couple of years ago that pretty much all cases of domestic and family violence have a technology component. It's not all offline or physical violence. There's also the use of technology to threaten, to harass, to monitor and basically keep someone under surveillance or to stalk them as part of the DV cycle.
The scale of tech abuse can be quite hard to get your head around. Toby Halligan spoke to Stephen Wilson, the CEO of Protective Group, who brought in a range of the types of devices that can be used in tech abuse.
So, Steve, we've been talking through the different kinds of technology that people can use to track and monitor and film and, you know, interfere with people's emails and a whole variety of things. Can you talk through, you've brought in a whole variety of kind of tech and things into the studio. What do we have here? What are the kinds of examples of devices people use?
Yeah, so firstly, I think when we talk tech abuse, a lot of people think it's more around putting something on someone's social media, Facebook page, or it's more about texting. Tech abuse has gone the next dimension, where it's more also now about trackers, listening devices, hidden cameras, and spyware. So what I brought in today is a sample of a tracker that was found underneath a car. So that's one that uses a magnetic or a stick bottom underneath
a small black box. It's pretty innocuous. Like if I saw that in my car, I'd just assume it was meant to be part of the car.
Correct. If you even saw it, because it can be stuck up underneath the wheel hubs, in bumper bars, or underneath the chassis. So they can be put anywhere. This is a similar one, another tracker. It's even smaller. That one can just sit inside the car.
This is kind of the size of, what, a large matchbox maybe? Or like a matchbox car even? Like this is a really small, wow.
Look, they get even smaller. You can get them down to something the size of a 50-cent piece.
Do you mind if I take a picture of it?
No, go for it, for sure.
Down to the size of a 50-cent
piece. And probably easy enough to conceal in kids' teddy bears, someone's shoes. I've heard of one where a lady actually had to put into a walking stick so that he was following her everywhere. This little one here, this is a hidden camera. So it's just a matter of this plugs into a charge and you hide it behind a wall and you stick that little part at the end there, at the end of the black wire there. That would poke out through a power point or a hole in the wall or through something in the roof. And they can log into that through the app on the web and they can watch everything that someone's doing.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And so this is like, again, to just describe this, this is even smaller than the previous one. I mean, like you say, that's not that much. It's a bit wider, but it's about the size of a 50-cent piece overall.
Correct.
When you look at it, and it's small, it's black, it's innocuous. It just looks like a bit of gear.
And the camera, you wouldn't notice in a wall or near something, would you?
And what kind of, like, is this stuff, I mean, feels a bit James Bondy to me because I'm cool and down with the kids, clearly, and up to date. But how expensive is this kind of stuff?
Oh, you can buy it from $20, $20 or $30 upwards. You can the small tile ones, the trackers, they're only, I think, $32 off the internet. You can have a turnaround in a couple of days. So when I say tech abuse, I talk tech abuse in the social media abuse or the texting of messages or the phone calls is one form. The next form is these physical trackers, listening devices, cameras, drones. We found a drone that was positioned 25 metres above a lady's skylight. So the ex-partner had sent the drone up above her skylight and filmed her in bed. And the drone actually recorded that visual and took photos. And, so that drone came into our possession. So, as I say, tech abuse for social media, abuse through trackers and drones, and then the next one is the spyware, which can be put onto someone's phone, and you can virtually take full operation of the phone. So for some apps are for free, some apps are a couple hundred bucks. You put onto someone's phone, you can then do everything they can do. So you can read their emails, their text messages, you can listen to their conversations, you can look at their camera, their photos, and you can set it up so if they use certain keywords, so if they send a friend a text or their lawyer an email and say regarding family court, that would be programmed in. So if the word family court came up, it then sends an alert to the perpetrator who comes up on his computer and he can see where she is as well as read her messages.
Oh, my God. And you were saying as well, I think Monica was saying before, it's possible for people to, like, delete emails and, you know, actually... So
yeah,
it's not
correct.
Just monitoring things.
It's not just monitoring. Yeah, you have the ability to do that. And then, of course, and we're talking mainly family violence, when the victim... You know, the victim survivor is not aware that that's on her phone. Then she appears that she's being gaslighted. So he's preempting. So he would send her a text message saying, "How did your meeting go with your solicitor at 10 o'clock this morning?" And she thinks, "Well, how did he know? Is he following me?" No, he's read her emails.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And is this something that you see with members of the LGBTIQ plus community as well?
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. And I think even... I might have mentioned on the phone the other day, even last week we saw two clients from the community that, both going through tech abuse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
So what I often say, and I've spoken to Monica about it before, that we started doing this 7 years ago. So we're former detectives, and about 7 years ago we sort of fell into this space of trying to work out how to help vulnerable people. And we got contracts with the Salvation Army and some others and police across the country. So it was all about... looking at responses to keep people safe. But 6 or 7 years ago, most of the referrals we got, we get about 60 to 100 a week now, most of the referrals we got were around physical abuse, sexual abuse. Now, 6 out of 10 are tech abuse.
The growth of technology and smart devices is also meaning that tech abuse can now be perpetuated through people's homes.
So one instance was a lady who lived in an affluent area of Melbourne. She had split up with her partner. The partner was very IT savvy, and actually the partner had a large IT company and had since sold the IT company to a major telco and was contracted as a consultant to that telco. So he's really IT savvy. So they've split up and she's gone her way, but she's remained in the home. But it's clear that the home is set up so that the perpetrator of the violence can actually remotely look at the cameras. She had a dozen cameras at the house, but 3 or 4 of the cameras were inside the home and they actually had voice recording as well. So the perpetrator could sit to the side and see what she was doing. So watching through the cameras, listening to the audio in certain parts of the home, could also read her emails, through IP addresses, because how it works is if you can hook into someone's Wi-Fi, you can hook in their Wi-Fi and you can then see what they're doing on their computers. So the mistake a lot of people make, and women make, is that they don't change passwords. So a perpetrator leaves the home, they don't change the password, they keep the password to the Apple Cloud and the Apple ID and the Wi-Fi, and no, the perpetrators can hook in. So this perpetrator hooks in remotely, very IT savvy. She's being watched inside, listened to inside. She would email the gardener, for instance, and say, can you come and do the garden today? And the gardener would say, okay, I'll be there at 2 o'clock. But before he gets there, the gardener cancels because he received an email saying, don't come now. But it wasn't actually her that had sent the email, for instance. Oh, but she'd go to open the gate to get out of the house and she couldn't get out. Or the garage door would go up and down, or the air conditioner would come on off at all hours of the night because it was the smart home was controlled remotely. There was something else with that one too. I think that's right. When our technicians were on site looking at the cameras and changing some IP passwords, every time that Nick would change the password, someone remotely would hop in and change another one. So the IT technology was huge, yeah.
Much of our show is focused on the impact of tech abuse. So what can people do to fight back? I asked Rosalie O'Neill from the Office of the Children's eSafety Commissioner where people can get advice.
Yes, there is. We have the eSafety Women website. It's esafety.gov.au/women. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of advice there for going online, using social media, sort of on life admin stuff, if you like, yeah. Banking, shopping and so on, how to do that safely and securely. And there's a very important section about if you are in a DV situation and you're experiencing tech-facilitated abuse, these are the kinds of things you need to look out for. Yeah. Just bearing in mind, though, our website, we've just gone through a fairly substantial review and we're hoping to launch a refreshed version of the website in a month or two. So it's current, it's useful, but it'll be even more current and even more useful in a month.
Okay. Go ahead.
And I'd just say, coming back to, we were funded under the Women's Safety Package to Stop the Violence to build this program. But I do want to stress, domestic and family violence and tech-facilitated abuse happens to anybody. It can happen to anybody. So the advice there is applicable to everybody who might be experiencing it. It's not just women. It's, you know, across the population.
We also asked Rosalie what people who think they might be the victim of tech abuse should do when it comes to their devices.
Well, there's a couple of very important things to do, you know, at the first, and that is to, if possible, use a clean device at a safe location, one that the perpetrator partner has not had access to. It may not be safe to not use your old device, but if you're trying to find out information about what to do and make plans about, you know, your future with this, it's best to use some kind of clean device. So either the phone or computer of a very trusted friend, or the phone or computer at somewhere like a library where your, you know, the perpetrator partner hasn't had a chance to get access to it. The other thing we suggest is setting up a new email account just for safety planning, but only set that up and use that from the safe device. I mean, the idea is to stay as far as possible away from devices that may be compromised, to make sure that you're not going to alert the perpetrator that you're getting help, or even thinking of leaving, because it's at that point of deciding to leave a relationship that the risk to the woman, the physical risk to the woman, does escalate quite significantly. And then generally, the safety and security in advice that we all should practice, actually, and that is setting up passwords and passcodes on all our devices, checking the privacy and security settings on each device to make sure they're not giving away location, and that kind of thing. The use of Bluetooth, turning that off unless you're actually using it. And in these cases, we do ask that they ask their friends and family, their trusted friends and family, not to tag the woman or her children in Facebook posts, for example, or photos, or check them in just so that they're not inadvertently giving away information about where they're now located.
Arian Potts also wanted to know how people who are concerned that family or friends might be experiencing tech abuse can assist.
This is a little bit of a sort of left field question, but I had a situation where I knew a friend was doing this to his partner, and the partner kept asking, you know, what's going on with my phone? And I kept telling the partner, you know, you've got to talk to him about this because, you know, I feel really uncomfortable. And, you know, sorry, I keep banging something. So if you know that this is happening to someone close to you, what's a good way to address that without...
Yeah, that is tricky because you don't want to put them at greater risk, for example. But making sure that they're aware that A, you're on their side and you believe them if odd things are happening to their devices. A lot of the issue is that women have great trouble getting people to believe her that these things are happening. But to point her to where the advice and resources are for looking at her phone or computer or that kind of thing to make sure that it hasn't been compromised, or to how to turn on the security settings and the privacy settings. Mm-hmm. But, you know, often with a friend or a family member, it's a matter of support and being there and understanding and listening, but gently pushing towards where the professional help is.
Annabelle Daniel, the CEO of Women's Community Shelters, wanted to be clear, though, that the answer isn't to just tell victims of tech abuse to get offline.
You know, so often the advice to women, you know, particularly if they've been stalked and harassed on social media, is, well, just get off, you know, just leave. And from my point of view, that's a way of making sure that you know, it's the victim that's erased from the space that they're actually entitled to be part of. You know, no one should have to erase their identity or their online safety because of abuse or harassment by somebody else. And so from my point of view, I think there's practical steps that you can put in place to, you know, to continue to safely navigate, you know, online spaces without, you know, without disclosing locations or with, you know, doing so in less risky circumstances. You know, obviously in terms of the tracking stuff, there are absolutely steps that can be taken, but it's very much the case. It depends on what the individual's experiencing, a bit of an audit of what's been going on.
And often technology can be helpful to those who are experiencing family violence as a defence, something Monica Blizzard from KHQ explained to Toby Halligan.
I was wondering, because a lot of what we talked about, like obviously it relates to domestic violence and family violence more generally, are you seeing the use of digital technology to actually hold perpetrators to account? Like say, for example, tracking their location to establish, well, you actually have been hanging around outside this person's house, or you have been sending these messages. Are courts and police using that, do you think, to the best possible, you know, are they maximising the benefits of that?
Look, it's hard to know what the police do. We don't know until they actually enforce the breach. But I can say to you that the advice I give my clients is to use the technology as a defensive weapon. Yes. So when I have clients who have separated and they're living under the one roof and I'm fearful, I'm worried about what might transpire, I tell them to download a recording device. Yes. I tell them to have their phone on them at all times. Mm-hmm. And I tell them that if they are suspicious that anything's going to happen, to have that recording happening. Because the only way I can actually prove something has happened is with the technology.
Yes.
Ironically.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, and I guess this is part of this, you know, technology does cut both ways, and in circumstances where it is being misused by perpetrators for criminal purposes, there are ways that fighting back's the wrong kind of language in these contexts, but, you know, people can use it to protect themselves. Or
What's really interesting, though, so if we get an intervention order for a victim, as part of the standard orders, it will say that the perpetrator is not to keep them under surveillance. Often the perpetrator will react by getting an intervention order against the victim, and it will say the same thing. So sometimes the law will actually stop you using that technology. But in a situation where you have no orders in place, absolutely, we have to advise our clients to use the technology. It's the only way. Otherwise, it's one person's word against the other, and the court does not assist in that scenario. It's a matter of pushing the client to have a final hearing, huge legal expenses, cross-examined in the witness box, and then the judge will decide who's telling the truth. That's a long journey.
We've been exploring the issue of tech abuse, and much of the picture has been quite grim. We wondered, though, whether the larger issue of family violence has been getting worse or better. And we asked Monica from KHQ.
Like, this is a big meta question, and tech stuff does feed into this. Are we getting better at handling this space? Because it seems like for my whole life now, there have been people saying this area of law is kind of broken. It doesn't help victims of domestic violence. It fails people in so many ways. It's really expensive. It's really hard. The police and courts aren't responsive enough. Do you think, are things getting better? I've kind of put you on the spot there, but, like, are things getting better? Like, over the course of your career, have you seen them get better?
I have to tell the truth, and the answer is no. I mean, there have been recent developments. So there was a recent change to the legislation so that a victim cannot be cross-examined by the perpetrator if they are unrepresented, and that's a huge victory. I mean, one of the cases that moved me very early in my career was a case where I had to sit through and watch my client, who was an extreme victim of family violence, be cross-examined by her partner, such that she was physically sick whilst giving evidence. So it was quite a traumatic experience for her and for everybody. And to know that that doesn't happen anymore is a huge victory. But that's, you know, been close to 20 years to get that across the line. The biggest issue, I think, is early intervention. It's just not possible. We don't have enough funding for judges. The judges don't have enough time to intervene early. We have cases where there is urgency and we go to the court and we try and get an urgent hearing date and they're not back. The judges don't have the time. So on the one hand, I think I could say, you know, there are significant problems with how our court systems are dealing with these cases. But on the other hand, it is under-resourced. It needs more funding. And if we had more judges and we had more availability, early intervention would be a possibility. And that would dramatically change the outcomes, I think.
Mm. Do you get a sense that courts and police are keeping up with the shifts in digital?
No, I don't. I have a real frustration with how family violence is managed by our police, because what I see and what I experience with clients is inconsistency in their approach. The ability to get an intervention order is a key strategy in keeping people safe. I do have people say to me, it's just a piece of paper. And ironically, it is just a piece of paper, but it's a piece of paper that can force the police to act. So it's a very important piece of paper. And it's really the only legal step we can take to stop someone coming to an address or stop someone attending a school, or and it's a piece of paper that's recognised by all authorities. But when it's breached, what I'm finding is that the police are sometimes failing to follow through with those breaches, even when they're serious. And what I'm finding is on other occasions, minor breaches are being pursued to the disadvantage of the family, because I'm thinking of one case in particular I have at the moment where there is actually CCTV of a perpetrator approaching my client in a public area, and the police have basically confirmed that they don't see that as a breach, because in the CCTV footage the client actually approaches the person and says, "Don't follow me, don't come near me." But the intervention order says you cannot contact or approach. Mm. So it's a clear breach from my perspective. We have video evidence and yet it's not being pursued. So there's a real frustration from my point of view, because these orders are meant to keep people safe.
Mm-hmm.
They can only keep people safe with police intervention,
mm-hmm.
and that police intervention is not consistent.
But it does seem like there are major challenges for law enforcement and the courts around this issue. So, like, overall, it's obviously quite a spooky problem. Like, I think it kind of raises a bunch of pretty fundamental questions that, as a society, we're struggling to grapple with. You know, mm-hmm. the fact that technology is increasingly integrated into our lives and literally, like, it's literally on our person, yeah? Like, we all take it for granted. And I think, like, our society has historically been pretty terrible when it comes to family violence in particular. A lot of that's gendered, like obviously in the LGBTIQ community. That isn't necessarily a component of every one of these issues, but our communities traditionally really struggled as well to get law enforcement to engage with issues of family violence. That's getting a little bit better in some places, but it's still a massive problem, and it's kind of hard to see how you stop the increasing encroachment of technology on our lives and the impact that'll have on really vulnerable people.
I honestly don't see an end to technological advancements, because fundings from big corporations, and I think the general younger generation, that's where we aim to go, but we often forget the negative fallouts of such advancements.
I think the answer for me really is just to become a monk and move to the Alps.
Well, I like that.
You just have to hope that you don't get reception up there, because, you know, like, if someone's got spyware on your phone, they can still, they'll know you're in the Alps.
Yeah.
Anyway, look, I know we've reiterated this a number of times throughout this show, but there are a number of services if you're struggling with this. We are grateful to KHQ Lawyers and Protective Group for the time they gave us. This is a complex issue, and we appreciated their expertise.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.